Hello and welcome to the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 13th of May 2018. My name's TRP Watson, and this time I'm joined by Paul in London, Web Cowgirl, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Strictly Ballroom at the Piccadilly Theatre. This is a musical adaptation of Baz Luhrmann's classic film, award-winning film, of course, about a ballroom dancer who wants to inject a slightly more radical edge into his, well, it's mostly a pasodoble, and developing a kind of relationship with a shy young dancer who's not considered up to much, but he's forced because he wants to do all these radical new steps into teaming up with this, not quite the best dancer, but who has a background that suits his interest in a sort of a real paso. She comes from a Spanish immigrant community who understand how to do traditional flamenco, which influenced pasodoble, I believe. I'm not absolutely certain about it. Of course, Strictly Ballroom is the thing that gives us Strictly Come Dancing. Now, this premiered in Leeds in an adaptation by Terry Johnson, and is directed here and choreographed by Drew McConey. It started off at the West Yorkshire Playhouse in Leeds, but has been changed since that time. It got very good reviews generally from people who saw it in Leeds, and I'm not absolutely certain that everybody has loved it now it's come down here. One of the major changes, it appears, is that they have introduced Will Young as a sort of compere, and he takes over quite a lot of the singing duties. This production stars, in the two main roles, Johnny Laby and ZZ Stralham. Paul, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, I think, first of all, as you said, because this version now, which has landed at the Piccadilly Theatre, takes all the songs away from the characters and gives them to the band leader, which I believe the touring production didn't do, it feels like it's the Will Young show now, rather than Strictly Ballroom the musical. And I think, depending on whether you like Will Young, probably will depend on whether you enjoy this show. For me, I don't find his voice particularly good for the theatre, or his light pop vocal didn't always suit the songs that they've given as well. So it's felt like he struggled to make the most of those songs. So I think if you're going to give it to a particular singer, you should at least have the music that suits their voice quite well. And it feels like some of the decisions they've made to sort of compensate for that, such as, you know, increasing the sound amplification, it gives the impression that he's just singing with a canned backing track, as if it's like karaoke night. So it's not necessarily the most pleasant thing to listen to at times. And I think for me, that was the whole problem with this piece, that actually the whole concept of having a band leader is a brilliant idea, actually, and actually it resolves the problem of when should characters break out into song or when they should just be focusing on dance. I think that's a great idea. But just the way it was executed here didn't do the show justice. I mean, the other thing, too, is the movie was full of irony and lightheartedness, even though it had this ridiculous story about a boy daring to dance his own steps in the cutthroat world of amateur ballroom dancing. You know, it didn't take itself seriously. But here, everything is, you know, hit over the head, rammed home at you. There's no subtlety about this piece whatsoever. And I think that's also where the light touch and the irony of the film is lost when it's being given the musical theatre treatment. Having said that, though, Johnny Laby and ZZ Stralham are, as to be expected, are terrific in the lead roles. And they give it incredible style and pizzazz in the piece. And, you know, there is a thrilling pasodoble dance sequence to close the first act, which actually really, if the piece was, you know, consistent throughout, people would be giving this, you know, standing ovations and raves. But with this band leader character introduced, who's Will Young at Piccadilly Theatre, it feels like they don't know what to do with him. He gives a lot of superfluous narration, and he doesn't always sound the best either. And the show also builds up to the, you know, the big competition finale where, you know, Will, the hero, Johnny Laby, who can dance, can sing, and can act. So in many ways, he's a lot better than the main actor in the Baz Luhrmann film, who could dance but certainly couldn't act and certainly couldn't sing. Will he follow his heart and dance his own steps, or will he fall in line? And, you know, it's all hard to tell because there's this cheesy finale that doesn't even involve Johnny Laby and ZZ Stroll. And they kind of sort of like stand at the back and watch it all take place, perplexed just like the rest of us. And so you kind of think, well, that seems like a wasted opportunity completely to have some sort of, you know, brilliant dance finale with them at the center. Instead, I think the production just really lost it there. And I think that for us, for me and my partner who's watching it, we just thought, what the hell? So in the end, there is an obligatory standing ovation that you have to do and dance around and all that sort of thing. But you will be perplexed and wondering, why? So in the end, I think it was a bit of a disappointment, this one.
Web Cowgirl, what do you think?
Well, I'll give you the headline, which is I went and saw it, was it Tuesday of last week? And I went back and I saw it on Tuesday of this week. I found it an incredibly engaging show that satisfied a lot of the ticky boxes, which are why I like to go to musicals. I almost regard musicals as a completely different entity from straight theater, and my expectations of going into them are really, really different. When I see a straight play, I want to be engaged with the story. I want to completely, well, I guess maybe a lot of the things are the same. When I go to a musical, I want to come out feeling good. I want to be whistling the songs. I want to feel dazzled. I want to forget that the world is such a terrible place. And Strictly Ballroom absolutely satisfied my desire to go to a play and just forget about everything and have a really wonderful, you know, 2.5 hours. It's almost difficult to call it a musical, though, because there isn't really actually that much singing. But the songs that they had were rather, I don't know, almost sadly, you know, songs from my youth. So because they were singing, you know, using Billy Idol's Dancing with Myself as kind of a ballad, and I think some Cyndi Lauper songs, but it was all of this music from the 80s that wasn't done to move the story forward or to build character. It was just like they were going to be having a dance number and they were going to have some, you know, they were just going to have live singing and live music to accompany the dance. So they just pulled some crap off of the New Wave back catalog and like dropped it in there. It just happened to be that the songs that they were playing was music I really enjoyed quite a lot. And I liked having it done on stage, but the singing that happened never really seemed to be about here is a song. It was really just music to have the action on stage happening too. But the action on stage was so vivid that I wasn't sitting around being sad about the musical numbers that we could have had because we had super, 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 super dance and really amazing costumes, which I think felt fairly true to the original because the whole palette of fluorescence, of nauseating fluorescent pink and fluorescent green and fluorescent orange. I mean, it's all just kind of horrifying, but you know, put on the stage like that and sort of given the time period that it's supposed to be set in, which I was constantly confused if it was meant to be the early 80s or the late 70s. It was just so, the garishness of it just became almost confectionery. You know, it became like a meringue, a pavlova, just too much, and all of that too much became really very just perfect. The story is enchanting. Enchanting is not the right word. The story is interesting enough with this. You've got a sort of a flawed male character who does have a big ego and isn't really particularly concerned about the female character played by ZZ Stroll, who wants to dance. It's improbable that he would work with somebody and get them good enough to go into a big dance competition in 3 weeks. But, you know, you have to let those things go because it's a musical. And the way that his character develops from, you know, being so completely caught up in himself and in winning and in, well, what he's caught up in, though, is just dancing his own way. I don't feel like they really, really got into, like, you know, him dancing his own way. But it was fun watching all of these other dancers and the actors really, you know, had that feel of top drawer West End talent. I was particularly fond of the woman who played the mother, who had such a repertoire of funny faces that she could pull. She really chewed up the scenery. And when you've got that many people really pulling out the stops to just be right there, right in front of you. I mean, you could almost see this show as coming out of the British music hall tradition. And it was a really good time. I also was impressed that they had authentic, accurate flamenco dancing in there. And the father of Zizi, I didn't look up his biography to see what he's done, but I watch a lot of flamenco dancing, and the flamenco scenes, I mean, of course, real flamenco would go on for quite a bit longer than just like the little snippets that we had for the show, but we had a chance to enjoy some honest to God, good flamenco dancing on a West End stage. And anybody who knows anything about flamenco dancing knows that if they were going to have someone doing flamenco dancing as a part of ballroom competition, that they would never have put him in a bullfighter's jacket. That was just ridiculous. But frankly, if of all of the ridiculous things that might happen during a musical, the thing that I'm complaining about the most is someone's wearing a slightly inappropriate costume. Well, that's actually really pretty small. And otherwise, this was my equivalent of a Marvel superhero movie. I just sat there, you know, and wanted to jam my face full of Prosecco and treats and just watch it over and over again and enjoy all the bright and shiny costumes and the dancing and the great acting. And if you like musicals, you may find that you do actually enjoy this quite a lot. And if you don't like musicals and you don't care about people doing ballroom dancing and the thought of people with fluorescent feathers on their arms revolts you, this probably isn't the right show. But I think this is an extraordinarily good night out, perfect for hen parties, perfect for gay men who like music of the 80s and like watching people be shiny on stage. I will probably wind up seeing it another time when I'm having a particularly bad day and I just want to go and forget about my troubles.
We're now going to talk about Not Talking at the Arcola Theatre. This is an early play by Mike Bartlett, written in 2006. It was originally commissioned as a radio play. This production at the Arcola is directed by James Hillier, with a design by Amy Cook, and stars David Horovitch as James, Keke Markham as Lucy, Gemma Lawrence as Amanda, and Lawrence Walker as Mark. We have two seemingly unconnected stories here. One is of an elderly couple. They got together just before the Second World War, and their happiness is clouded in the initial parts of their marriage by, first of all, Lucy loses a child, which causes a slight estrangement. And then when James decides that as a Quaker, he cannot fight and cannot be part of the war and gets registered as a conscientious objector, he is approached by a woman who applauds his stance. And they begin a relationship which is disturbing to Lucy when Lucy finds out about it, and she forces James to make a choice between her and his mistress. What he doesn't know, and what we later find out, is that his mistress is pregnant and has a child, and there are consequences of that. The other story, which, as I said, appears to be unrelated, is a story about Mark, a young soldier, and Amanda, also a soldier, where they are at a camp, and we begin to see it is possibly the kind of story that we heard of a few years ago, where people are mysteriously committing suicide while out on patrol. Young soldiers, they've been bullied, they're unhappy. Mark describes meeting Amanda at a get-together party in the barracks, and later describes seeing one of his friends having sex with a female soldier behind the dance hall. And he watches, but realizes that this might not be a consensual act, but he doesn't say anything, especially because there are NCOs and sergeants there with his friend. We later discover that Amanda, who also describes meeting Mark and them having an attraction, that it is in fact Amanda who has been attacked, but she can't say anything about it and can't really do anything about it. She is getting victimized to a certain extent, and we seem to be heading towards the inevitable conclusion where she's going to mysteriously commit suicide, only it's not going to look like suicide in the way that these things often do, and there's also the possibility that it won't be suicide. Mark begins to understand what has happened and tries to sympathize, and they do have a kind of relationship, but it is blocked by this terrible thing that happened to Amanda. These stories come together when it is revealed that James is in fact Mark's great-grandfather. He gets to find out about this other family that he has. It is when he finds out about this other family and the way that Lucy, his wife, prevented him from ever communicating with his mistress, ever writing to her or talking to her, leads him to leave Lucy and head off to find his other family. He eventually gets in contact with this young boy called Mark, who's very confused, and he discovers the story. It is all done by people really addressing things to camera. There's not an awful lot of interaction other than when somebody is telling a story that you might get them to interact like that. But largely it is voices speaking directly to the audience and very limited interaction between characters. I think towards the end we get a little bit of more interaction. And it is very much a radio play. And to a certain extent it's fairly static. We're not actually seeing anything. It is all being described. But that said, it is, I thought, a very effective piece and really shows you the promise of Mike Bartlett. I mean, it's probably not as great as some of his other plays, but it is, you know, this portrait of some of his early work, which is, I thought, very valuable to see. One of the things that features throughout it is playing the piano. This playing, I think, especially Chopin, which both Lucy and Amanda are able to play the piano and like playing a particular piece of Chopin. And in fact, by a coincidence, Lucy's music gets into Amanda, which is a rather strange and convoluted tale to tell. It is very well told, as I said, and very well acted. I mean, you've got great people like Keke Markham and David Horowitz to play with, and Gemma Lawrence and Lawrence Walker are extremely good in this. Very well worth seeing, I thought. And as I said, you know, Mike Bartlett, one of our, as we like to say, our big three writers at the moment. It's an early piece, but it shows all his promise, and it's really rather good. What did you think about it, Gareth?
Yes, I was very glad I went to see it. As you say, it's a very early piece. Before this, he'd only written four smallish fringe plays, a couple in Edinburgh, one in Leeds, and then one at the Finborough. And, of course, since then, he's gone on to do great things. He's given us Charles III, Albion, adaptations of Chariots of Fire, Dr. Foster on TV. So it is interesting to see this early work. What surprised me when I sort of read around it was that it's actually one of seven radio pieces that he did, some of which were five-part dramas for Woman's Hour. So actually, he did a fair bit of radio stuff. So it's almost a kind of third strand of work. Because when we talk about his stage work, you know, we talk about his minimalist plays, things like Cock and Bull, not connected, and then his sort of more epic plays like Charles III and Albion. So this is a kind of third strand of sort of radio plays. And another one of them was called Love Contract, which came a year later. And that actually was quickly adapted for the stage because that got onto the Royal Court as Contractions a year later. Contractions was revived last year by Definitely Theatre. They staged it in a trading floor of a bank building incredibly successfully. So I can see why they're going back and looking at his early work because of what he's produced later and because of the quality of the early work. So I think that Defibrillator are to be congratulated for digging out and finding this because it is a piece of quality work. You do know it's from radio in a way because there is a limited interaction between characters, a limited sort of dialogue and monologue. I think it does kind of feel a bit like a radio play. But I thought they did stage it well. I mean, there was, you know, there was really only a platform and a piano, but it was, the lighting was very successful and the acting I thought was outstanding. So I think it is actually staged very well. And I think it's a very interesting story. I mean, in a way, you puzzle a bit because you've got these two things going on. You've got this sort of wartime story of this young couple, and that moves on a bit. But then you've also got this modern day story of these soldiers, and it takes a while before they connect. And I quite liked that, you know, piecing that puzzle together. I quite liked, you know, the way that it wasn't laid out for you, but it sort of came in pieces and then you linked them together or put them together a bit like a jigsaw until you sort of got the final picture. And, you know, there's links between his conscientious objections and the fact that his great-great-grandson is a very willing participant in the forces and indeed war. So it's got sort of interesting connections like that. I mean, it's only a 70-minute piece, but I actually found it a very satisfying 70-minute piece. And I was very glad I caught it. It's, you know, I've seen now something like 15 of Mike Bartlett's plays, and he's the sort of playwright that you do want to sort of fill in all the gaps. So whenever something comes up, you know, a revival of something you haven't seen or like this, a radio adaptation, it's well worth catching. And I think it does show the early days of a talent. We're saying all of that, but I mean, it's only 15 years since he started writing, so we've hopefully got masses more to come. But it's certainly something I'd recommend.
We're now going to talk about The Prudes by Anthony Neilson. This is Anthony Neilson's new play, directed by Anthony Neilson himself, with a design by Fly Davis. It stars Jonjo O'Neill and Sophie Russell. They are a couple who haven't done it for a year, 40 months and 4 days to be exact, and they propose to sort it out in front of an audience. Web Cowgirl, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, it's pretty hair-raising to walk into a theater for the theatrical experience and be told right at the beginning that what you're going to be getting is a more of a sort of a Tijuana donkey show, as we might have called it back home. I've, you know, certainly seen, boy, even just this week, more than enough simulated sex on stage. It's not that common, but I was a bit worried. And looking around at the audience, I got the feeling that actually maybe they didn't want to watch people having sex on stage. And I will say, as a spoiler, you do not have to watch this happen in the play, which is a complete relief. So if you are holding off buying tickets because you don't like to see that kind of filth, I can assure you, you're perfectly safe. What the play does do is explore the difficult interactions of adult human beings in a long-term relationship, not just in having sex, but in talking about sex. And I promise you, it's not that much easier in America either. It is such a fraught subject with so much emotion attached to it. And the expression of desire, the ability to express desire, and the difficulties that you have when people have different levels of desire, with being told no becoming a true rejection of you as a person. And that affects how you deal with the person, and it affects how easy it is for you to talk to them about the issue of having differing desire levels. And I've really never seen this on stage before, this kind of difficult conversation and this exploration of the psychological underpinnings of having a conversation about what you want, why you want it, and maybe why you don't want it, and how you can try to bridge the gaps in a relationship when the levels of desire differ. In addition, in what was a complete surprise to me, but sort of mentioned at the very beginning, this play deals with the impact on a couple of, I think it might be, I can't remember, I think child sexual abuse is fairly maybe appropriate, but just say the impact of sexual trauma in an earlier part of somebody's life, what impact it has on the individual's and the couple, a couple, as adults. I also believe this is something I have never seen on stage, and I thought it was depicted very realistically and very humanely. And it's funny to, you know, to be bringing this up in a play that is actually generally so funny and so lively and so engaging. I had a really great time watching this play, and it was the timing, I think it was 70 minutes straight through. You know, the time just whizzed by, and it was a fantastic example of how you can do like a short play that never wells up and, you know, just gets in there with its subject and really, really engages. And it was all perfectly timed. But having the play go into this area, which is truly a dark place, and give the audience some enlightenment about how these kind of things affect people, and to have it done so truthfully, it was really very surprising. I didn't think the play was going to do that, because, I mean, it's one thing, like most people as adults have the experience of being in a relationship where one person wants sex more than the other does, even if we don't ever see that on stage. But what I don't see is these conversations with people about how you deal with something traumatic happening to your partner that wasn't related to you. And every bit of that just rang so true for me. And I am a huge fan of this play. I thought it was really great. And I saw somebody else complaining that it wasn't very appropriate in the age of Me Too to have a play that felt so sorry for the man. But, you know, these kind of couple issues are difficult for both sides of a couple. And I don't think men really have a space where they can talk about this openly. And this is part of, you know, the problem with the patriarchy, because it represses men and women. It's not just that this is a hard topic to talk about, but I think men are particularly silenced about having these kind of conversations. And to see it happening on stage, for me, I think almost could help an audience see that in their issues, they are not alone. In their difficulties in having communication, they are not alone. And to feel like maybe more empowered to have these really hard conversations after having a chance to see, admittedly, a made-up couple, but after seeing another couple kind of trying to push through it. And I thought it was really great. I mean, I can't imagine it getting a West End run because it was, you know, such a short play, but I really hope to see it on stage again. And thumbs up for John Joe and Sophie for carrying through with it and not losing the nerve.
I thought it was very interesting, and it did capture what I felt to be, you know, something very real in it. It's something that Anthony Nielsen does quite a lot. This appears to be more sort of going back to earlier plays, like The Censor, like Stitching, which I believe are much more graphic in what they do. I would probably recommend that people read The Censor with great care, because it does have a rather disturbing ending. And also, I mean, Stitching apparently has a very disturbing ending, but I haven't seen that. That is a fairly major, but that's a fairly famous play of his. But more recently, he's been doing an improvisational building up of plays rather than a particular subject. But it does seem with The Prudes to have gone back into something which is very much about sexuality and the relationship between people, which he has done in, as I say, plays like The Censor and Stitching. It is very well done, I think, and also it feels real. It feels as if it's taken from, you know, real life, real sensation. I was reminded of one or two stories that I've heard in some of the descriptions of trauma that people have, and that kind of you often say the impotence of not being able to help and have, you know, feeling that it's nothing, although it is nothing to do with you, and it's not your problem. That idea of I can understand that kind of the impotence of not being able to help and not being able to say anything about it or do anything about it and not being able to gauge whether or not, to what extent you should talk about it, or the kind of support that you might want to give. You know, you do, because if you give too much support, they might feel like a victim, or if you don't give any support at all, you're, you know, a terrible person. It is that kind of dilemma that this deals with, and seems to be the object reason for why they haven't had sex. It's a very fascinating look at a relationship, and I thought it was done extremely well. It's perhaps not to everybody's taste, but I did think it was rather well done.
Well, I think anybody who's really not comfortable with having these conversations, period, you know, might hate it. And the style, which is having the characters frequently talk directly to the audience rather than talking to each other, you know, that's like kind of a difficult thing to manage. I thought it was an object lesson in how to do it well, and it's also very aware of itself and of there being an audience. And it's the people aren't monologuing. They're literally having conversations with the audience. They say, like, you've had this happen to you before, right? Thought so. I mean, they're really, it's really quite different from a typical stage play. And I think some people just might feel like the spotlight was on them too much and would just run away from it. But I thought it was handled very sensitively. It turns out I've only ever seen one play by him before, and that was the play Get Santa, which also dealt with sexual desire. How does a dog and a cat have a relationship with each other? But just very, very humanely. I think I'm going to have to make an effort to see more of his stuff now. It was really just, I just thought it was really good. You could hardly ask for, you know, a better investment of time and money.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.